Welcome to the Practice Brave podcast. I am the host, Brianna Battles, founder of Pregnancy and Postpartum Athleticism and CEO of Everyday Battles. I'm a career strength and conditioning coach, entrepreneur, mom of two wild little boys, and a lifelong athlete. I believe that athleticism does not end when motherhood begins, and this podcast is dedicated to coaching you by providing meaningful conversations, insights, and interview topics related to fitness, mindset, parenting, and of course, all the nuances of pregnancy and postpartum. From expert interviews to engaging conversations and reflections, this podcast is your trustworthy, relatable resource for learning how to practice brave through every season in your life. 10 years ago, I was navigating what it was like to be a pregnant athlete for the first time with a coaching background. I thought that because of my education and my experience as a coach, that I knew how to train during pregnancy. And I basically kept doing what I'd always done under the belief system of if I was doing it prior, I could keep doing it. That if I had a fit pregnancy, that it would guarantee like a really easy delivery and that I would bounce back. And I kind of believed that we were meant for this. So why should I limit my fitness? But there's just more to it than that. And it's not the alternative, which is don't lift over 20 pounds or just all these like really conservative fear-mongering guidelines that we also were told back then. And frankly, still, there is a major disconnect in what was available for education and information in the fitness industry. And it wasn't until, honestly, like a really traumatic birth. And I struggled a lot postpartum with understanding my body and the shift and experience in my identity as an athlete transitioning through motherhood. I just felt like I got rocked and I felt like nobody understood me and could help me. Yet I also knew that I wasn't alone in how I was feeling. So that kicked off what turned into becoming my business, Pregnancy and Postpartum Athleticism, where I started coaching and learning and really working with the pregnant postpartum population, which I've done for a decade now. It took honestly just so much research connecting the dots between core and pelvic health, both during pregnancy and postpartum, long-term athletic goals, and then honestly the psychology component of the transition that an athlete makes as she navigates pregnancy, postpartum, and into motherhood. And so I created Pregnancy and Postpartum Athleticism, which is an online coaching certification for coaches, practitioners, and honestly, anybody who wants to better understand, support, and help guide pregnant and postpartum athletes through these seasons on behalf of their lifetime of athleticism. We have gone on to certify over 3,000 coaches around the world who are doing an incredible job of educating people in their online and local communities. The waitlist is open. Enrollment will be opening soon. And if you get on the waitlist, you will be able to save the most now that you will at any other point throughout the year. So please, if you've considered becoming a pregnancy and postpartum athleticism coach, whether it is to help your current clients, your gym members, or even yourself, this is the time to do it. So get on the waitlist and know that enrollment will be opening soon. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Practice Brave podcast. Today I am here with Emily Musket and we are going to be talking to her about her process as a now retired Olympic lifter and mother. She is an Olympian and I think we're just going to have a really valuable conversation that's going to be relatable, whether it's to other professional athletes or honestly just any female athlete who's navigating pregnancy, postpartum, and their performance goals. So Emily, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about yourself and your background, both in the sport and then just like who you are.
Yeah. So I'm now a retired Olympic weightlifter. I weightlifted for about 13 years in total, coming from athletics or track and field over in the US. I moved to weightlifting because I knew I was quite a strong athlete and it was something that I thought I would be pretty good at. I knew I wanted to compete in an Olympic game, so I wanted to pick a sport where I knew I could reach that goal. I wasn't sure at the time if it would be weightlifting because, you know, there's lots of questions around doing a sport like that when you're a teenager. You think, oh, I don't know if I want to lift weights. I don't want to look like a man. I don't want, you know, the usual stereotypes that come with it. But in fact, you know, a couple of months into training, I just felt so much better about my body already, you know, having that kind of building a bit of muscle tone and feeling stronger, seeing that progress, because it's so easy to monitor, isn't it, in a sport such as weightlifting. I just felt pretty empowered and confident and knew that I would go on to pursue it. So I really, really, really wanted to compete internationally. So I managed to do that within a couple of years of lifting, which was a fantastic opportunity. I missed out on two Olympic Games. So 2012 and 2016, I was the reserve lifter. So I was like the next in line to go. It was, you know, they were both quite gutting for different reasons. But for me, you know, I knew I still had one more shot and Tokyo was going to be, you know, the last hurrah. And I ended up having to try and qualify in the weight class above my own. That was quite a struggle because I had to then start eating and, you know, trying to really bulk up and add some muscle mass. And I found out about a week before I flew that I was selected for Great Britain and going to the Tokyo Olympics. So yeah, it was a amazing experience. It was quite different with the COVID aspect of things, without crowds, without spectators, but to actually achieve that lifelong goal, yeah, was unbelievable. And for me, it was like, I've ticked that one off and I'm happily going to retire now. I think, you know, getting to an elite level in your sport when you're approaching, you know, early 30s, you then are then thinking about and conscious of everything else you want to achieve after that. And so having a family is then in the back of your mind. And so, yeah, retired from Tokyo and then got pregnant in very early 2022 and had my little boy Joshua in November 2022. So it's been a mad few years, but really exciting at the same time.
Absolutely. And I just like love the perspective that you bring. And I kind of want to like rewind a little bit, because I feel like, especially in the US, Olympic lifting for women didn't really get super popular, it seems anyway, until we all found CrossFit. And like, yeah. I know for me, that was like 2010 probably. And that was when it became, even though like I had lifted in college and was exposed to the Olympic lifts, I feel like culturally in the fitness industry, it didn't get like, quote, popular until CrossFit kind of got a little bit more on the map, especially for women. So when did you start Olympic weightlifting?
I actually started in 2008, right back then. And I only got into it because my coach, because I did pole vault as a sport, like the athletic side of things, my coach wanted me to do some extra strength and conditioning training as part of my usual pole vaulting training. And he sent me off to a specific weightlifting coach to take me through the lifts and, you know, general squat movements and things like that. So I ended up going to him, but he was also one of the national weightlifting coaches. And he straight away, you know, obviously watched me move or watched me lift and said, "You'd be a really good weightlifter." And I was like, "I'm definitely not changing sports. I'm going to stick this one out." But lo and behold, you know, 6 months down the line, I decided I would actually change over, because it was one of those, I stopped enjoying pole vault a little bit. And I knew I had some natural abilities with lifting. I knew I was strong and, you know, quite mobile. So decided to just crack on and give it a go.
Yeah. Well, I can see, I feel like people are like pole vaulting to Olympic lifting, but I actually see a lot of parallels with like the explosiveness and just how dynamic you need to be. And honestly, just like a really great athletic foundation to do both of those sports. So it does make sense. But were you ready to leave pole vaulting behind, like emotionally, since that is a sport you've probably had dedicated a lot of time and years to?
I was at the point that I changed over, I definitely was ready to do that. I'm quite determined, so I didn't want to just give up on pole vaulting, but it got to a point where I wasn't really improving. I'd stopped enjoying it. I knew that I wasn't going to make it to the same levels as, you know, the international pole vaulters on the stage. So, yeah, I thought, it's now or never. And I knew weightlifting was going to be a bit of a long game in terms of progress. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was a well thought out decision, I'd say.
That makes sense. And so were you training with a lot of other women, or was it mostly men? Like, what was it like during that time frame within the sport of Olympic weightlifting?
There definitely weren't that many females still. It was up and coming. There were a couple of girls in the gym at the time, which made it feel, you know, a bit more normal, I suppose. But I knew that it was a sport that didn't really have the numbers that athletics did, or, you know, other common sports. And I don't know, it didn't really faze me too much. I just, you know, had lots of male friends. I'd competed alongside, you know, all other male athletes, and my training group was quite male dominant. So it didn't really bother me too much. But it certainly, I noticed a massive difference through the years of my career, seeing many more females start weightlifting. And like you said, I think CrossFit was massive in that. It just showed females that actually lifting weights is good for you and makes you also look good as well. Look good, feel good. And being strong is just like a bonus that comes with it.
Yes. And I love reflecting on this, like in combat sports and Olympic weightlifting and lifting for women in general, because I'm like, this, our history of it being more popularized and embraced among female athletes and the fitness community in general is like, it's very recent. Like, yes, we've had women involved in sports and lifting for a long time, but I think the, for it being embraced and not being this outlier, that is still very recent for a lot of female athletes. And you're in your 30s, right? So the fact that you started and you've seen the evolution between when you started and where you are now, of how much this sport has grown for women and how much it's been popularized and embraced, just goes to show you like how short-lived the history really is. And you've kind of been part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think today we're seeing a bit of a change in that lots of young females are getting involved, you know, in their teens, which is what we want, really. When I started lifting, you know, and CrossFit, all the women seemed to be a tiny bit older when they first started lifting weights. So now there's a bit of a shift, and, you know, you're getting those 14, 15 year old girls kind of giving it a go, and seeing the benefits from getting involved in weightlifting and that kind of strength training. So I think it's really exciting, and I hope that we'll see a bit more of it in schools, you know, because when I was at school, we didn't even have one dumbbell in the school. You know, it was a girls' school. It's just the kind of traditional female sports that we did. But I think times are changing, so it is positive.
Yeah, I love reflecting on that with other women who, like, I mean, I didn't get exposure to Olympic lifting or anything like that until I was in college. And it was only because I was, you know, competing as a student athlete there. But it wasn't something that was like really introduced in other fitness settings that I probably would have had exposure to, it wasn't until like we started maybe CrossFit that we started seeing more of that. And I don't know, I just like highlighting that because I think it's really easy to look at social media, look at the growth we've seen in these sports and just sort of assume that like, well, yeah, like this is normal. And like you and I can look back and say, like, no, this was very recent popularization, yeah, just being embraced, as a sport and just more exposure to this sport. No one knew what a clean and jerk was or what a snatch was. It just wasn't, it wasn't like bench press, you know?
Yeah. How much do you bench? The classic. Right.
Yeah. And then honestly, just how transferable the Olympic lifts are to all sports. Right. And I think that's something that people kind of overlook as well.
Yeah. I think you see Olympians and all these multi-sport athletes, but they never kind of show their strength and conditioning work. They don't show the training that goes on outside of their actual sport. So I think most athletes out there, like 90% of all elite athletes, are doing some kind of weight training, some kind of Olympic lifting. You know, it's much more common than people realize.
Yeah, absolutely. And so talk to me about, we're just going to kind of hit on some more sensitive subjects. Talk to me about like the, you compete in a weight class sport. What was that like for you? Because I know so many different female athletes do have weight class sports that they participate in, and that can be really hard to navigate, especially if you kind of grew up in that sport before there's maybe as much awareness and insight as there is now. So what was that like for you?
It definitely had its challenges. When I first started, I was in a lower weight class, which meant that I had to diet. I had to cut a few kilos before competitions, which was a bit of a struggle because I am a bit of a foodie. So, you know, having to, you know, bring in that discipline and be really strict with my nutrition, I did find quite hard, especially as you get closer to competition, trying to manage the weight loss and maintaining your strength levels so you can actually lift was very difficult. I did that for several years, but I got to a point where I wasn't really improving. And for my height, I knew I probably needed to be in a heavier weight class. So I made a decision to move up weight classes. And as soon as I started fueling my training properly and getting the right amount of calories in, I noticed a significant improvement in my strength levels. So my performances went up. You know, I started to win some international medals. It all kind of came together. And for me, that was a massive eye-opener because, yes, I enjoyed cutting down because of the way it made me look and feel, but it wasn't necessarily right for my performances. So as soon as I actually gained a bit of muscle mass, put a bit of weight on and like I said, fueled correctly, it just made such a big difference. But as a female, getting your head around the fact you're watching your body get bigger, you know, same as when you're pregnant as well, it's like, whoa, it's a hard thing to register, but when you see the results, it's kind of worth it. And I knew that I knew when I retired, I could do something about it if I wanted to and lose those few pounds, you know?
I just think it is so important to acknowledge that because when you're in a weight class sport, we often think like everyone just wants to cut. They want to go down a weight class. I think that's going to be better, but there's so much to be said for competing right around ish where you are and being able to fuel your body and not be in this deficit while then trying to balance, like you said, the performance side where you can't be depleted. And it's not like combat sports. Well, maybe it is where people will dehydrate themselves, but then that really affects performance. So I think it's such a fine line for people that are competing to want to cut, but know that they'll probably perform better if they're closer to where they're naturally, what their natural homeostasis is for weight.
Yeah, definitely. And then you've also got to think about, you know, all the important health stuff. There's some people out there that will cut and their periods will stop and it will really affect their hormones and things like that. And it's just not a healthy place to be. So it's a real, it has to be a sensible decision. I'm a big advocate for like moving up weight class when you're unsure, go for the higher one, see how it works out. And, you know, you can always drop down again if you need to.
And that seems like really great advice for anybody who's just maybe wanting to dabble in powerlifting or Olympic weightlifting, or they're wanting to do a local meet or something like that, where like, don't worry about, you know, cutting down a little bit, just like be exactly where you're at, see how you do. And then you can make more informed choices later on in the process.
Yeah, exactly. Just prioritize the performance and the recovery that goes with it. And yeah, the rest should sort itself out.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for sharing that point. I think it's really helpful for others to hear. So you mentioned that you were a reserve twice for the Olympics. And that must have been a really challenging position and role to take. Granted, I'm assuming there's just so much sacrifice and time put into your training. So talk to me a little bit about that process and what that was like for you.
Yeah, it was a tough couple of experiences to go through, really. 2012, I suppose I didn't know I would be in the running for a place until we kind of got close to the games. So because I was still only 4 years into the sport, it would have been a bit of a bonus to go to a games that close, you know, that close to the start. So that, I suppose, I wasn't expecting too much with that Olympics. However, I did find myself in the mix and I was lifting, you know, weights that were up there near the qualifying standards. And basically it came down to a political decision and someone else got selected over me. And I was also working at the Olympics. So I'd managed to get myself a job with the organizing committee. And I found that the most challenging part of it all, because it wasn't the fact that I'd not been selected. It was the fact I'd not been selected. And then I had to watch everyone who had been selected and, you know, be there, being involved, having to be professional and just do my job, but also feeling really, really disappointed at the same time. So, yeah, that was definitely one to remember. And it spurred me on, you know, for the next few years to come. And then 2016, I was in better shape. I'd only just moved up weight class, so I don't think I'd really reap the benefits of that when it got to the qualification period. And we only managed to qualify one female place for that Olympic Games, and someone just lifted a little bit more than me. And then one of our other lifters got injured. So it was close again, but I fairly, you know, missed out because I wasn't good enough. And that's, you know, that's just how sport is, isn't it? Can be very cutthroat like that. But again, I was super disappointed, super gutted. You know, just felt like, why am I doing this? I'm putting so much time and effort into this sport and not achieving the goals that I want to meet and want to get to. And I did need a few months, I think, to kind of go back to, you know, the basics of, do I enjoy this? Do I want to pursue it? Is it worth it? And I did. Yeah, I went back to basics, took my training right back. I changed coach. I ended up actually moving to Australia in 2017 because my husband was offered a job out there. So I thought, do you know what? This is going to be a great opportunity to change things up. And it did. And I managed to achieve that goal in 2021, but not without its challenges. But those kind of setbacks that I experienced along the way were absolutely key to me being able to go on and achieve my lifelong childhood dream.
Absolutely. And I think something that's not really talked a whole lot about, especially for female athletes, is the lows and the depression and the burnout and honestly just like the mind fuck of competing and competing so hard for so long, so intensely, so high volume, and then to have some kind of letdown or some kind of, like, whether it's a loss or you're not making a team or you didn't perform the way you want to perform, like where there's some sort of like buildup to just like slap in the face, and how far down that kicks you, because it's so hard to then, like, I love the sport, but the sport doesn't always love you. And that's hard. Like, that is so defeating. And I think that's when we actually see a lot of female athletes quit, right? When they say, they're like, this is too toxic. Like, this is ruining my mental health, my emotional health, my life, my relationships. Like, it can be so defeating. So is there any advice or even validation that you can offer to people listening?
I think I would just say, like, persevere through those setbacks. I know it's easy to say, but if you want something badly enough, you will find a way that works for you. And I would also say that, as I mentioned before, that change is so important. It's very easy to just get set in the same routines with the same people. And sometimes you just need to get out of your comfort zone and mix things up a little bit in order to reach your goals. And if, you know, you change one thing and it doesn't quite work, then you change something else. And it's just a bit of trial and error. But I would just say persevere and, you know, keep your head down and keep working, because you can get there.
Absolutely. I do love that advice about, like, just being willing to change it up, because I think that there's so much in some ways like loyalty or safety when it's like, well, this is the team I train with or the coach I train with or the school I train with or whatever. And it can be really hard to separate our comfort from our potential. And you know, I see a lot of female athletes, especially professional athletes, just really struggle with those choices of like, well, what's best for me versus what, you know, I don't want to upset anyone or disappoint others. Yeah. We tend to take on everyone else's feelings.
Or it's those uncomfortable conversations, isn't it? That's the hardest part, really, I think, especially like moving coach, you know, you feel like you're breaking up with someone and it's difficult, but you've got to be selfish. If you want to achieve, you've got to put yourself first and do what's right for you. So yeah, get comfortable being uncomfortable, as they say.
And I think, you know, I get to have a lot of these awesome conversations where I like really get to know the behind the scenes of what professional athletes experience, right? And so many people were tough, strong women, but on the inside, we're still sensitive and have feelings and are people pleasing and want to make our coaches happy. Are all these people, fans happy, community happy? Like we are achieving not just for us, but like the pressure to achieve and perform for everyone else too. And that can be so crippling.
Oh, 100%. I think half of performing on a global stage is, or even just, you know, a local stage, half of it is trying to manage your own expectations, but everyone else around you, you know, you think, what are they all going to think of me? You have a bad performance and you just think that everyone's going to judge you. And it's, yeah, as a female, we're definitely like to think that way, don't we? And we're very kind of aware and can be self-conscious at times.
Yeah, and it's so hard to not absorb that. And then I would think I did like one local Olympic lifting meet. It was literally nothing. So I don't have a lot of experience with Olympic weightlifting, but I feel like the pressure of being able to perform in that exact moment has got to be like, there is such an art and a science to getting your brain and your body connected with that kind of timing and that peaking, like literally in that moment. How did you dial in your self-expectation, the noise of anybody else? How did you dial that in continually in so many high-pressure moments to perform?
I think for me, I didn't start out that way. It took me many years to get to that point where I knew what my pre-lift routine would be. I knew what headspace to get in. I knew how to execute. But it takes a lot of failed competitions and a lot of, you know, rough experiences where you get distracted or you lose your focus and you do something slightly differently and it throws you off. And, you know, you have to have those moments where it really affects you and you don't perform as well as you'd like to in order for you to then be able to dial in later on down the line. So, I got to a point where I was fully reliant on the competition atmosphere and the pressure in order to lift decent numbers. I couldn't really replicate it in training anymore. It was a case of, I need this adrenaline. I need this environment. This is how I'm going to perform well. And I would just take a big, deep breath. And that was my main kind of go-to as I walked onto the platform. I'd stand behind at the back of the stage, close my eyes, take a big breath just to kind of slow everything down. Then I'd just walk up to the bar, left hand, right hand, left hand, lift. And it was just trying to empty your brain and just do the same routine. It just worked for me in the end. But like I said, took a while to get to that point.
I love that you shared that. And I think because it's so hard to shut off the noise. And then I love that you're able to learn how to like really leverage that adrenaline of the environment. Cause I think sometimes the environment is what like crushes people, but it sounds like over time you learn to use that to your advantage. And that's such a gift.
Yeah. Thank you. It was great to be able to get to a point where I knew I would be able to perform if I needed to. I mean, before Tokyo, I actually lost my mum to motor neurone disease, which is ALS in America. And I actually lost my ability to lift during training. I'd get this really crazy mental block, which I feel like lots of women get in this sport anyway. But I just could not commit to my lifts. And I don't know, it was probably the mental experience I was having in my personal life kind of coming over to my training. But I went into these competitions with really terrible build-ups in training. You know, I wasn't hitting anywhere near the numbers I needed. But yet when I came to competition, because I'd had 12 years prior, I knew I could do it. I knew on the stage with everything, you know, in the right place, with the adrenaline, with my coaches, I knew I'd done the strength work. I knew I had the technique, and I knew I could just make the lifts if I needed to. So I think if I'd have been 4 years into my career at that point, I probably wouldn't have been able to, if that makes sense. So there's something to be said for that experience.
Absolutely. And like self-trust like that, especially in a performance-based environment is, I mean, that is years and years of reps of doing that. You know, like self-trust takes so long to build because it's also filled with a lot of failures. It's also filled with like, well, that didn't work. And then that doubt. And it's, I think it's that managing the doubt within the building of the trust and I guess stacking more bricks on the trust side over time, but that is, it is such a long game. And I don't feel like that part is as acknowledged and it weighs so heavily for women who compete.
It really does. I think I read somewhere that to become an expert in something, you have to do it for 10,000 hours. And I kind of get that. It has to be so repetitive and you have to just go with it, you know, for so long and just take on board all of the setbacks and, you know, the bad times, the good times, and just use it. You know, learn from it, use it until you get to a point where you're comfortable and you, like you say, trust yourself to just be able to do the job. And I definitely feel like towards the end of my career, I was in that headspace and I was totally reliant on that as well.
Yeah, you know, and this is just making me think, like I talk so much about athletic maturity and how you can actually become a better athlete when you're not 22. Like it's, you can become a really good athlete later in your 20s, into your 30s. And I think so much of it is because you do have more of that self-trust. You do have more years of fails and trial and error and like small wins, but you stack that self-trust kind of the longer you stay in the game. So even if it looks different than how you competed maybe in your early 20s versus how you compete in your early 30s, that you can actually be a better athlete. And I think so much of it is that athletic maturity that is just built brick by brick, painful moment after painful moment until you really know how to dial that in for you.
Yeah. I think you just learn so much about yourself along the way and not just the training, you know, all the other little components with it that get you to that point where you just, you know what works for you and you know what doesn't. And it's even having the confidence to say, you know, no, I don't want to do this exercise in my training program because it doesn't work for me, you know, rather than just going along with it and being like, okay, I'll do what you say. Like you build that confidence to have a voice and to know exactly how to get the best from yourself. And I definitely think early 30s, you know, that was when I peaked in my career. And I think that's for a reason, you know, that maturity, like you said.
And it's wild because that's just not focused on in when we talk about like strength conditioning research or performance for female athletes. It's almost like, you know that I always say like athleticism doesn't end when motherhood begins, right? But beyond motherhood, it doesn't end when you're done with your collegiate career. Like, and it doesn't end at 25. Like we can continually get better and measure what better looks like in a lot of different ways across our lifespan. And I think that that's where, you know, the the research community, strength and conditioning community, the sport community, performance community has like honestly failed female athletes. It's not looking at it from this, like, you're not, you don't have to just peak at 22. You could actually peak at 32 or 42 yep. and beyond. It's so different for every single person out there. And I think that you have such a beautiful example of that.
Oh, thank you.
So tell me a little bit about what your Tokyo experience was like. Tell me about your lifts and just the overall experience.
Yeah, it was, it all came about quite quickly. As I mentioned earlier, I found out very late on that I was going. I was trying to qualify in a weight class above my usual weight class, and I had to wait for all the quota places to be reallocated after the rankings were sorted. It was very complex. You'll be here all day if we go into that. But I ended up having to wait for some doping cases to go through like the legal process. And then I was bumped up into the rankings from as a result of that. And managed to get on a plane. I missed the announcements and the kitting out and things like that, but to actually go out there was unreal. The experience itself, we went to a prep camp in Tokyo. Team GB were put in a hotel and we had, you know, all the facilities that we needed. We could go and train and do our lifting. And then we had, a really good kind of setup in terms of food, recovery, physios, like medical teams. We weren't allowed to leave the hotel though, because of the COVID restrictions. So that was, a bizarre experience, because you kind of felt like, yes, we're in Tokyo, but we're not. We could be anywhere. I remember we had a 30 meter strip outside the hotel, like a concrete bit of road that we could go and do little lengths up and down in the morning for like half an hour. And that was our only outside time. Which was a bit, you know, prison-like, and had a bit of cabin fever, but I suppose it's part of the memories, isn't it? But leading into the competition itself, like I said before, I wasn't in the best headspace, really. I was fully aware that I was approaching the end of my career, and I was also extremely aware that my training was going pretty badly, and I had this mental block. And for me, like catastrophizing, I was like, I don't want to have a mental block on the Olympic stage. Like, this is my childhood dream. I don't want to mess this up. I want to make sure I, you know, finish on the best possible note. And even though there were elements of the Olympic experience that were so enjoyable for me, you know, there were many moments with my teammates, you know, going to the opening ceremony, holding the Union Jack, the Great Britain flag, wearing the kit, going to the food hall, the village, like it was absolutely fantastic, everything I'd ever dreamed of. But the process and the pressure that I'd placed on myself was very overwhelming, and I felt so stressed. I remember I'd do my training sessions, they wouldn't go very well. And then I'd go and have a little cry in the toilets down the end of the corridor. Like, it was, you know, when you just can't write it. It's your childhood dream, but you're there crying your eyes out and feeling like a total failure. And but when it came down to the day, I started having this mental block in the warm-up room, and I was thinking, here we go. But when I actually got out onto the platform, I was like, right, you're going to end your career on a good note. You have to commit to this. And we did end up dropping the opening weights down a little bit to allow myself to kind of get into the swing of things. And I managed to get all three of my snatches. So for me, that was a massive relief. Wasn't personal best, you know, wasn't the, you know, the best lifts I've ever done in my life, but it was 3 out of 3. It was a good start. When it came to clean and jerks, I hadn't really lifted anything that heavy in training. So it was always going to be a bit of potluck as to how they would go. I did end up doing a deadlift on my second attempt, and that threw me, because I was like, it's reared its head, you know, this mental issue. But I went back into the warm-up room and just said to myself, you cannot make the last lift you ever do on a competitive platform. You can't do it like that. You need to complete the lift. And I just dug as deep as I could and managed to secure the last lift, which again wasn't a PB, wasn't, you know, the heaviest lift ever. But it was a good solid lift. And I just was overcome with emotion after that. It was a lot of years of sacrifice and a few painful months that it all came out in that moment. And I'll never forget it. It was pure relief, actually, more than anything, more than elation or anything like that. It was just absolute relief.
I love everything you just said and how you told that story. And I also love that you said that your feeling was relief. Like, so many people don't understand, when you're a high performing human, we very rarely get like actually excited. Like, our excitement is actually just relief being expressed. You know, it's not like, yay, I'm so proud of myself. It's like, no, it's like, thank God. Thank God it all paid off, right? And it's just it's like that years of buildup for this one moment and all of it coming to fruition. And that's it's just such a beautiful journey.
Yeah, it's, you know, the pressure that you can put on yourself is huge. So once that's lifted and you know you've done, like, even though perhaps it wasn't the result you wanted in some ways, but you got through it, you managed it, and you achieved it. So it's it was just relief over anything else in that single moment.
Absolutely. And then you knew right then that it was also time for you to retire.
Definitely. It had been a long 13 years and that was the top of the goal list, if you like. And I'd done everything to get there. I was really happy with my career that I'd had in the end. You know, I didn't set out to win any kind of international medals, but I did along the way, and I just felt like that was the right moment. And I knew I wanted to start a family, so it just made sense, you know, to just step off the platform and leave it there, leave it on the highest of highs.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you got pregnant, you retired, you got pregnant. And what was your pregnancy like? Were you still wanting to participate in Olympic weightlifting? Or were you like, I need a break from that?
Well, funnily enough, I did actually feel like this is the one time I don't need to lift, you know, I don't need to put that pressure on myself. You're not competing anymore. If I was still competitive, it might be a different story. But I also do enjoy the training side of things as well. So I think I stopped the Olympic lifts, stopped snatching and cleaning at around 12 weeks, 13 weeks. You know, as soon as I'd had that first scan, knew everything was fine, I was like, well, I'm not going to make contact with the bar if I don't need to. You know, this, I don't need to carry on these lifts at the moment. And I just felt like I wanted to be as active as possible through the pregnancy, but not put any pressure on myself in terms of maintaining certain strength levels or anything like that. I kept my squats going. But even then I dropped them down to, you know, I reduced the range, did half squats for several months. And I just enjoyed not having to follow a program and just doing what felt right, to be honest.
From what a lot of professional athletes tell me, it's like, it's the first time they've ever had freedom to just kind of do what they wanted to do with their body and their training, and just kind of there's just a lot more grace during that season, and willing to just adapt where there's not, you don't have that pressure to maintain or to perform.
Absolutely. I think I was a little bit nervous though, because I'd had a miscarriage, but an early miscarriage before this pregnancy. I was a bit nervous as to what I should be doing, you know, and I'm sure you'll agree, there's not a great deal out there. You know, I think I read something that was like, make sure you only do exercise to the point where you can still have a conversation, like you shouldn't be getting out of breath, you know, and stuff like that. Like, that's so vague. Right. And it was very unclear, but because I was a little bit nervous about it, I just thought, you know, I'm going to go with the flow and see how it goes. You know, I trusted my body, I trusted myself enough to be able to just do my own training on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely. And then what was postpartum like for you?
Well, I had a C-section and the recovery was painful.
Were you an emergency C-section, like after a lot of labor, or what led to the C-section?
Yeah, so I was in labor for about 37 hours. I got to about 9.5 centimeters, but my cervix was really swollen. So they were like, right, we need to get this baby out because it's not happening naturally. And to be honest, I had preempted in my head that I might end up with a C-section just because of the way my body was, you know, when you just know that, you know, it might end a certain way. So I was fine with that. You know, I just wanted the baby to be healthy and all things to go well. But I was not prepared for how sore I would be.
After that many hours of labor and dilating to 9.5 centimeters, like that's basically having both forms of childbirth in one.
Yeah. Well, the exhaustion starts there, doesn't it? Right. I don't think you ever recover after that.
Yeah, we're just chronically tired.
Yeah, that's it. But the just the muscular kind of soreness for at least, I think, the first week, I was thinking, what the hell is this? This is pain like no other. Just like, I remember trying to walk along all stooped over because I couldn't stand up straight. But after that first week, things started settling down and I was able to walk, and I enjoyed going for a little walk. But I also just really loved sitting down a lot and cuddling baby, like cuddling Josh and just relaxing. It was a lovely time. It was a nice bubble to be in, and I just embraced the rest, to be honest with you. It was crazy.
Because it's so hard. I think when you're like a high achieving person, that was probably like the first time you ever really slowed down and gave yourself that permission to do less than what you normally would do. And I think that it is so freeing when we actually allow ourselves to do that, but that can be really hard to do. So I'm so glad that you said that and that was something that you were able to really embrace.
Yeah, I think I knew that I wouldn't get the time again. And I knew it probably wouldn't be of benefit to anyone if I started stressing about doing exercise and things like that. And I don't know, you have to let your body just heal, don't you? That's the priority, you know, for you and your baby. I mean, I didn't even set foot in the gym, I think, until about 8-9 weeks postpartum, even though, you know, the guidance is 6 weeks post C-section. But I just really took my time with it. And I think because I knew that I have that mindset that when I start again, I will be on it. You know, I'll give it everything and do the best possible routine that will work for me and get me back to a decent shape. So I just waited until I was at that point where I could do that rather than like half-hearted, you know, and, you know, put any pressure on myself. I didn't want to do that.
Well, I love that your athletic maturity translated so well into your pregnancy and to your postpartum approach. I think I actually see that often with professional athletes because you have such perspective on the big picture of training, of healing, of progression, of setbacks, of like how long it actually takes to rebuild or to peak again. And a lot of us, like average athletes or exercisers, there's like a lot of FOMO, you know, like there's so much fear associated with having time off or feeling like, well, I'm not doing enough, or I should be doing more, or my body should look a certain way, or I'm being lazy, and just so many stories. And so it's so easy to be really critical and to push things faster than what their body's actually ready for. So I love that you gave yourself so much grace and time and just knowing yourself at such an intimate level of knowing, like, I know I can take this time because once I get back to the gym, that's going to become part of my routine again.
Yeah, exactly that. I think, you know, I don't think I won't ever get back to the shape I was in as an athlete, and that's okay. But you do get other people when they know what you've done previously, they're like, what's your best lift? And you're like, well, it was this, but now it's this. And, you know, it's just feeling, accepting that, and not feeling like, well, should I be lifting what I was before? But, you know, I think motherhood gives you a new perspective on things. And, you know, just to be back in the gym is an achievement in itself, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it is. It's such a shift in identity and how you spend your time and what your mental and emotional and honestly physical, like what all your, like where all your focus goes. And motherhood shifts it quite a bit, but it still does allow for you to dabble and have goals and have interests that, you know, are still part of you. That part doesn't, I try to tell these athletes, like that part of you doesn't die. You're not washed up. It's not over. It's just gonna be different. And it's kind of up to you what you want that different to look like.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't imagine going back to weightlifting competitively at this point. You know, this conversation might be totally different if I was still competing. But for me, exercising and having smaller goals, whatever they may be, gives me something to focus on. And just mentally, it's a nice break, you know, from, you know, the daily life that's so much more different than it was pre-children.
Yeah. So how do you like to spend your time? What does your exercise and routine look like? Do you have any kind of athletic related goals on the horizon, or where are you at right now?
So I started doing some CrossFit because I wanted to feel, you know, that feel healthier, do a bit more kind of cardio type movements, because you don't do a great deal when you're Olympic lifting solely on its own. So I do about 2 CrossFit classes a week. Then the rest of the time I do some Olympic weightlifting, because that's, you know, that's my my jam, if you like. You know, it's my go-to. I enjoy the movements, I enjoy, you know, the lifts. And then now and then I might go for a run, but I have to be in a certain mood for that, because running's hard work for me anyway. But to be honest with you, you know, I get 1 hour about 4 or 5 times a week to go and exercise. And that is a huge reduction on the training I was doing, you know, before Josh. You know, I'd have like 4-hour sessions 6 days a week. But I'm so grateful to have that 1 hour that I just try and maximize it as much as possible. So like you said, things are different and it's what you make of it, but I'm just feel really lucky that I get that time to do what I want and to, you know, work super hard in 60 minutes and just feel like I've achieved something out of it at the end.
Absolutely. And I mean, it is just about building this lifetime of athleticism. I mean, you've had such an incredible career as an athlete, and it's not over. That part of you as an athlete is over, but you still get to have so many different forms of the ways that you get to express your athleticism, whether it's at CrossFit or the kind of life that, you know, you get to live as a mom with your family. And I think that's like the really beautiful part of all of this, is it's about that lifetime that we're creating. And, you know, different seasons are going to, you know, yield different interests and results and whatever, but it's just, it's not over. And I love that you're living that out right now.
I am. Yeah. And I, you know, I love having stuff to work on. I think in CrossFit, you've obviously got a ton of gymnastic movements. So for me, trying to, you know, learn those skills and work on those skills is just a massive challenge and something I've never done before. So I just chip away at those, and it's cool, you know. I love having just something to work towards. But that being said, you know, my postpartum body isn't, you know, where I'd like it to be, and I think lots of women can relate to that as well. I think I sent you a message once saying, I've got diastasis recti, and I was panicking a bit about that, but that's also something that I need, you know, I know I need to work on. That's another goal, to try and reduce that as much as possible and keep on top of all the core and breathing exercises and things like that. So there's so much out there for us to work towards. It doesn't have to be something huge, you know, just tiny little stepping stones to work on each day.
Absolutely. All those micro goals really add up over time. And that's what helps build out what we get to do, how we get to express ourselves through fitness, movement, and our overall health. And I think you're just such a great example of the athletic maturity and how that continually serves you, whether it's during your time as an Olympian or now your time through pregnancy and postpartum. You've just given such a great example of that. So thank you for sharing.
Oh, thank you so much.
Where can people follow you or just learn more about you and, you know, watch your life unfold?
I'm mainly on Instagram. I'm not very good on any of the other social media platforms. But it's just at EmilyGBWL. And I try and just update some of my training videos, some of my life photos, life videos, share Josh and how he's doing. Just keeping it as real as I can.
Well, you've certainly kept it real on this podcast, and we really appreciate you sharing. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Practice Brave podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a review and help us spread the work we are doing to improve the overall information and messaging in the fitness industry and beyond. Now, if you are pregnant and you are looking for a trustworthy exercise program to follow, I have you covered. The Pregnant Athlete Training Program is a well-rounded program for pregnancy with workouts for each week that are appropriate for your changing body. That's 36 weeks of workouts, 3 to 4 workouts each week, and tons of guidance on exercise strategy. We also have an at-home version of that program. If you are postpartum and you're looking for an exercise program to follow, the 8-week postpartum athlete training program would be a really great way to help bridge the gap between rehab and the fitness you actually want to do. From there, we have the Practice Brave Fitness Program, which is an ongoing strength and conditioning program where you get new workouts each week and have a lot of guidance from myself and my co-coach, Heather Osby. This is the only way that I'm really offering ongoing coaching at this point in time. If you have ever considered becoming a certified pregnancy and postpartum athleticism coach, I would love to have you join us. Pregnancy and Postpartum Athleticism is a self-paced online certification course that will up-level your coaching skills and help connect the dots between pelvic health and long-term athletic performance, especially during pregnancy and postpartum. Become who you needed and become who your online and local community needs by becoming a certified pregnancy and postpartum athleticism coach. Thank you again for listening to the Practice Brave podcast. I appreciate you. And please help me continue spreading this messaging, this information, and this work.